Blog Talk Radio.
Radio, the segment Bringing Sexy Back. I am your host, Gail Delicious Johnson, here along with one of my co-hosts, Terry Brown. Good evening, darling. How are you?
I'm good, Gail, and you?
I am fantastic, darling. You know me. I've been through many a storms, but, you know, I have to be blessed because I did wake up this morning, and I'm not going to complain, you know, because the best part of the day is seeing the day. Yeah. So I've, you know, have a few announcements I'd like to make. Next week we're going to have a very special guest. D.K. Walker is going to be here. I think that's next week. Let me check and be sure because I don't want to have someone else that. Yeah, D.K. Walker is going to be here next Wednesday. And he wrote three books, The Ugly Side of Sex, My Childish Smile, and Dirty Secrets Between the Sheets. And the week after that, we're going to have, on the 15th, we're going to have Michael Matasarskis. I hope I pronounced his name right. But he's a gentleman who wrote a book called Wildlife, and that's going to be a very interesting show because I read a little of the book, and it's, you know, the misadventures of a Cosmo Bachelor, you know. So we're going to be with him on the 15th. And then on on the 10th, well, we're going to be here on a Friday on the 10th because that's a guest who can't make it on a Wednesday night, so that'll be Friday the 10th. And that's Christina, I can't think of her last name, but she deals with holistics. and, you know, different things like that. That'll be on the 10th. That's a Friday at 6 p.m. Then on the 22nd, we're going to have Diane Collins. And at the very end of the month, on the 29th, we're going to have Mitch Cradle, which is a producer, writer, and director, and an author, and he's also a detective here in the Washington, D.C. area. He's doing his first feature film titled Boss that will be premiering this summer. So we're going to, you know, be with him the last show in April. That's the 29th. Now, I'm making this announcement now, and I probably will make it at the end of the show as well, that a Blog Talk is going to be on hiatus for a little while. I don't know how long, but I will be, you know, keeping my co-hosts and everybody abreast to what's going on with it. I don't know exactly when it's going to go on hiatus, but I know I'm going to finish this month out. So anybody who sent me emails and, you know, waiting to get on the show, just be patient. I did get your emails, and I will be booking you, you know, as soon as things get clear when I'm, you know, back with, back in the studio again. But, you know, due to unforeseen circumstances, I'm going to have to step away for a little while. And I don't want you guys to forget, so, you know, go listen to the archives. And if you want to be a guest, still request that, because I am going to get all the guests on that did send me emails eventually. And I'm sorry that, you know, things are working out this way. And if it, you know, if you decide that you don't want to be on the show, that's, you know, pretty, that's good too, because, you know, it's your privilege to be on my show. And I do appreciate anyone who is a guest on the show, especially when you bring knowledge and, you know, bring a good time and, you know, have something to offer my listening audience and, you know, people who are into whatever it is that you're bringing to Delicious Talk Radio. Okay, so with that being said, we do have a most fascinating guest this evening, and I'm going to give you a little bit of information about him before I bring him on, our evening's guest. His name is David Merkatz, and David was born and raised in Brooklyn, New York, and at the age of 16 decided he wasn't happy in school and decided to learn a trade. David went to work for a locksmith distributor in Brooklyn for training, and it was a great decision. There was no salary, but as a way to learn a trade and get help obtaining his locksmith license. David opened his first locksmith business in 1978 in Brooklyn and was successful. In 1983, he decided to move down to the South Florida area because his dad had offered him to come down and stay with him rent-free until he could get a job or business started in the South Florida area. David found a job within 10 days of arrival to Florida and worked on the job for a year. He then opened his first locksmith shop in mid-1984, and it went well, and he sold it in 1989. David took it easy for a year, and while he was taking a break, he studied and got his Series 7 and Series 24 stockbroker's license. David was and still is a professional options trader. He then opened another locksmith shop, which also did quite well, and sold that one also after 5 years. David continued to open and build up another one or two shops and sell them for profit. By the year 2000, his best friend Jeff, who he knew from Brooklyn and grew up with, asked him to start a mobile locksmith business with him. They continued to run it until November 7, 2003, when tragedy happened. While driving home from their last job, they heard a bang in his truck and lost control, and the truck rolled over 3 times. Jeff was killed, and David was injured. David was devastated and never drove a locksmith call again. drove on a locksmith call again since. He then decided to hire independent contractors to do all the service and calls and set home and became a locksmith dispatcher. He continued to do this until August 13, 2013. On that day, David's life changed forever, and that is the purpose of his book. he decided to write a book on his experience with the law. This book and subsequent books he may write will be very helpful to people who are not familiar with how the legal system really works. And so without further ado, we're going to bring David in so he can explain to us what happened that day and how to change his life and how he came to write the book. Good evening, David. How are you?
Very good. Thanks for having me on.
Hello, David. How are you?
Very good.
That's my co-host, Terry. Okay. Now, David, you basically gave us a little history about, you know, you becoming a locksmith and your best friend being killed and, you know, how you built up these locksmith companies and then you began to sell them for profit and become the dispatcher, tragedy striking, and then something else changed your life. So what was that something else that changed your life and caused you to write the book?
Well, what happened was the locksmith business, once we got into mid-2000 here, 2005 and later, with the loss of the Yellow Pages, which people stopped using, it became a very competitive business. And unlike New York City, Florida is one of the few states that requires no licensing regulation of any kind until this date. So that means anybody can be a locksmith. No tests, no fingerprints, no nothing. So you had a lot of people coming down here doing it. So we went from doing really well to really poor. So what we did was we started putting up a bunch of websites with several different names to try to attract other businesses. And we legally registered all the names and got approval from the state of Florida under the Fictitious Name Act. They sent us certification. Now, the problem was that some of the names that we used in the registered, you know, with Florida were similar to some larger companies that were out there that have been in business for about 20 years. So, for example, if the bigger company's name was ABC Lock Shop and Security Center, we registered ABC Locksmith. And we did it to about five different companies for about 6 years, 7 years without any problems. Occasionally, we would get a complaint from the other company that we, you know, got one of their customers or something like that. But our websites, if you put the two together, looked nothing alike. They were totally different. And they even had a disclaimer on it that we were not the other company and with a link that you could actually click to be redirected. So we covered all our bases. We checked with three different attorneys. And out of the three attorneys, one of them told us that we could get sued for using a name that's similar, but because the state of Florida actually registered it, that's about all they could do. They were legally registered. But unfortunately, one of the companies that we had used a similar name was in a rich town of Palm Beach, Florida. And this company just so happens to do all the work for the town of Palm Beach, including the police department. And in February of 2013, we got a phone call, we need our lock changed. Little did we know, it was a setup. Sent one of our independent contractors that actually works for several companies. And he went up there, knocked on the door, and when he knocked on the door, they opened it up and said, yeah, we want this front door lock changed. Okay. So he took the lock off the door, went to his truck, and rekeyed it. In other words, like changing the cylinder. The guy didn't want the whole lock. Just wanted to change the key, which is a common thing. So he rekeyed the lock, and when he got done, the guy asked him if he could make a checkout to the company. And he said, I'm an independent contractor. You'd either have to make a checkout to me personally, and I'll give you a receipt, or you can pay cash. So he says, no, I'll give you cash then. So we paid him for the job, and after he got done, they tried the keys. Everything was fine, and he's walking out to his truck, and two cops knocked him to the ground and charged him and arrested him with burglary of an occupied dwelling, grand theft, and impersonation. And that was the beginning of the saga.
Okay, well, let me ask you this. How could they charge him with those charges? Because he was really set up. that's entrapment as far as I'm concerned, because, you know, it was a setup. He went over and did his job, and he wasn't impersonating anybody or robbing anybody. So how did that, how did they do that?
Well, what happened is, of course, remember, these cops were friends of the other company. And remember, we were using a similar name, not exact, but a similar name. So the basis in Florida for a burglary charge is that they can say that he misrepresented himself, which he really didn't do, because we had the name registered, even though it was a similar name. And they can say that they wouldn't have opened up the door had they thought he was the other company. It's a very, you know, vague law. And impersonation and all of that nonsense. And grand theft, he didn't steal anything. He took the, he gave you back your own lock. But you've got to remember, they can do anything they want when they arrest you. That doesn't mean the charges are going to be actually filed, but you have to bond out of jail based on the charges that you're arrested with, not based on what the state files. So you're already into, you know, you're arrested, you've got to be taken down. And unfortunately for him, the burglary of an occupied dwelling charge is a non-bondable offense. Because that's considered a, you know, a violent crime. Somebody's in the house and you broke in. So he couldn't even get out of jail. Yeah, that's what they did.
So after all that, well, what eventually happened, you know, how did he exonerate himself and what happened with that case?
Well, it went on and on. Naturally, it was an interesting thing because after being in jail for a day and a half, the judge finally set a bond for him, which was quite high, and, you know, it doesn't end there. Now that you have to sit and wait for the state to make a decision, and it was a very interesting decision. They dropped the impersonation charge, which is the one I thought that they would keep, because after all, that's what they were saying, we impersonated the other locksmith. And they kept the burglary and grand theft charge. But that was just the beginning of the saga. We had another independent contractor that received a telephone call from the same detective. And he said, I'd like you to come in for an interview. We're doing some, you know, an investigation. And my advice to him was not to go up there and do the interview, because interviews should be done on the phone. I don't trust, you know, that kind of an interview, especially police are allowed to lie when they want you to come up, you know, and question you. But he didn't listen to me, and he went up to do that interview 2 days after the other guy was arrested, and they interviewed him and put handcuffs on him also and arrested him for the same three charges. And that also was in February.
Okay, so you didn't, you weren't, did you ever get arrested for anything?
No, see, what happened was now that these two guys were questioned and all of that, months were going by, and I heard nothing. But in the back of my mind, I knew that these were just the independent contractors. If they went through them, and I was getting these weird phone calls from customers, and I knew what was up. Customers that had actually spoken to this detective, and he was going around calling up all the customers that we had done work for the different companies and making up all kinds of stories that we're a scam artist. We weren't a scam artist. We were out there doing what everyone else does. If somebody comes out with a product or a service, there are people that come out with something similar. It may not be a nice thing to do, but it's not a criminal act. It's something that if you don't like, you sue them for. It happens every day. So what was going on is I haven't heard nothing. Months are going by, so I retained an attorney. And I had my attorney call up the detective, and he would also would have liked me to come in for an interview, but I declined. I don't do interviews in person. So weeks were going by. All of a sudden, the first week of August, I got a phone call from the attorney, and he said, I have bad news for you. I says, what's the problem? He says, I got a call from the detective, and the judge has just signed a warrant for your arrest. And which was actually nice of him. He could have just come to my house, knocked the door down, which is what they normally do, and, you know, take you out in front of your family in handcuffs, but he didn't do that. He told us about the warrant. He wouldn't tell us what the charges were, which is all, it was more frightening. So with a few phone calls, I called up a bail bondsman that's a good friend of mine, and bail bondsmen are the greatest people in the world to know, because with today's electronic, it's amazing what they can find out. And he went into the system and he told me what the charges were. And he said, you got one charge for organized scheme to defraud. The second charge is money laundering. And the third charge is impersonation.
So where did the money laundering come in?
Well, I'll explain all of that to you. See, Florida money laundering is not the same as what most people think. It's in, these laws here that we have in Florida are very vague. Money laundering in Florida means making money off an illegal activity. So if you do anything illegal, you're a money launderer in Florida. It's not the same as you think, you know, you're washing money. It's basically, if you're guilty of organized scheme to defraud, if the jury comes back with that guilty verdict, you're automatically a money launderer because you made money off an illegal activity. So that's, and it's a serious charge. You're talking 20 years in state prison if convicted. So with that, I said, are these charges bondable? And he says, yes, you're going to have a bond of $19,500, of which in most cases bail bondsmen on state charges, they take 10%. So what I did was, I was smart. I met with Mark, and I said, let's fill out all the paperwork so I can give you your percentage and get everything well done. So this way I will go to the main jail the next day and I'll surrender myself, but I already have everything done, which is ahead of everybody's, you know, game. So what I did is the next morning I went up with a neighbor, dropped me off there, and I told him I'm here to surrender myself on a warrant. And I'll never forget, they looked like, I just don't look like the type of guy that would have a warrant out. But she saw it, and they came out, and it was 9:30 in the morning, and the guy, cop came out and says, okay, come with me. I went inside. He was very nice, actually, and he brought me inside and said, you know, you'll have to wait, and they'll call your name within 4 to 6 hours because it's a long process. But I got pretty lucky because I surrendered myself. They called my name by 11 o'clock, and they read me the charges, which I was fully aware of already. And as soon as they read you the charges, it's entered into the system, and the bail bondsman can actually see it in the computer, and he was watching for me. And as soon as he saw it, he pressed his little button. He doesn't even have to go to the jail and hits bond out, and that's it. So they see that you already made bond. So within a half an hour, they check for warrants, they call you downstairs, and by 2:30, I was processed out. So it was a very quick, you know, it doesn't normally happen that way unless you know what you're doing. I was actually home by 3:30 in the afternoon in time to pick up my son from school. It was very interesting. But that's when you know what you're doing and how to get yourself bailed out. But that's how these things happen. And the average person that spends in jail, if they're not aware of the system, how to do it, they can spend 24 to 48 hours in jail before you can see a judge.
Okay, well, let me ask you, does that apply across different states or just in Florida?
Every state there's a way you can actually bond out of jail without seeing a judge. I have a whole chapter in the book that teaches how to do that if you run into an unfortunate situation, even on a traffic stop. So you don't have to sit in jail overnight. There's tricks to the trade, so to speak, how you can actually bond out within several hours. And that's why I tell everybody you should always have a bail bondsman's phone number or card, because you never know. It can happen to anybody. Be pulled over and you have a similar name and there's a warrant. Happens all the time. I've helped a lot of people with this problem.
Now, what if
David,
you don't have the money?
Let me ask you. Oh, I'm sorry, Gail.
Go on, Chris. Terry.
I was going to ask David, Florida is a pretty wild state with a lot of things I've been seeing. And I'm just fascinated by how you had everything worked out, because the normal, regular Joe has no clue do if you get in trouble. They
Correct.
Have no clue. They don't know about bail bondsmen. They don't, first of all, they don't have the money.
Right.
And if they did, like you said, first you have to be processed in. No matter what happens, as long as there's a warrant, you still have to go to jail and do all that, and then you bond out. But think about all the people who have no clue on what to do in a situation, whether you're innocent or guilty. And I think it's a fascinating story that you're telling.
Yeah, it's there are, even if you if I was taken out in handcuffs and I didn't know about the warrant, knowing how to work the system and who to call and have a good bail bondsman on hand can be the difference between spending 48 hours in jail and 6 to 8 hours. And it's, you know, you don't want to be there any longer than you have to be. It's not a pleasant experience.
Well, let me ask you this, David. What if you don't have the money to pay the bail bondsman? Then you are stuck, or do you make some type of negotiation with him, or how does that work?
Well, see, most of the time, unless it's a violent crime, if, let's say, for a shoplifting or something, a minor crime, if the bond is $5,000, you really only have to come up with $500.
Right.
And as long as, you know, it's not a major bond. Mine happened to be very high because they were serious charges, and I had to come up with almost $2,000 for mine. Most people will scrape it together with a credit card. Most bail bondsmen take credit cards, and, you know, your bond would have to be substantially high not to get out. Even if on a $10,000 bond, for example, you only have to come up with $1,000. So it's not, I mean, it's a lot of money, but it's not as bad as coming up with $10,000.
Right. Now, something else I want to ask you, how do they set these bonds? Say, like, if somebody, it's not a violent crime, but, you know, maybe, I want to say something more than a thief, but maybe if someone got into a fight and bust somebody in here with a bottle, how do they set a bond opposed to that statute and opposed to somebody accidentally hitting and run somebody? Or do they set them the same? Or, you know, how is that done?
Every state.
Because no one was actually killed, but I can understand bodily harm being done. Does it go across the board like that, or how does that work?
Well, every state is required under the law for nonviolent offenses, because otherwise the jails, everybody would have to sit and wait for it to see a judge, and it takes forever. So every state is required to have set bonds for minor white-collar or nonviolent offenses. And every state does. The problem is most people don't know that you have a very short window to bond out. When they call you up to the – first of all, you're not allowed to make a phone call. The only time you're allowed to make a phone call, not when you're arrested, not until they actually call you up to read the charges to you. At that point, you're allowed one phone call. And if there's no answer, it's not going to be okay, you can use the phone again. You're going to wait till tomorrow. Well, they're not very nice. It's not a pleasant experience. It's filthy. It's dirty. You're treated like, you know, unfortunately, even if you're in there for a traffic arrest, it's very not a good experience. So that's why the bail bondsman should be the first call, because it's electronic today. They don't have to come to the jail even. So it's a great thing. I mean, unless you have warrants out for, you know, if you have a minor thing, like let's say you got picked up for shoplifting and it was $500. It could even be a felony. It's still usually like a $5,000 bond, which means you'd have to come up with $500. If you call the bondsman, once it's read, he can post that bond over the phone within seconds. It's so quick today with the electronic. Where if you call a relative and they don't answer, you're done. You're going to wait till the morning. And if you don't post your bond, depending on the time of day or night it is, within the first 2 hours from the time that you're arrested, you probably will be taken to downstairs or upstairs, depending on the jail, change your clothes, and wait till the morning to go to magistrate court. And that can turn a release, which could be 4 to 8 hours, into 24 to 36 hours, especially if it's on a Friday night or a holiday weekend. That's the problem. You're only going to get that one phone call, and if you don't do it right away, then you're going to be taken and put downstairs or upstairs, depending on the jail, and waiting for magistrate court. And they're in no rush, believe me. It's no rush. They got all night.
I want to say something, because this is bringing some memories back to me. I shouldn't be telling them myself, but I had a situation which really turned out well. My husband and I were living in North Carolina, and I was driving his car, and I had a little accident. Well, I didn't have a license. So the police, and the car was totaled. The police put me in this car, very nice. I was in the front seat. And he took me down to the magistrate. In North Carolina, they have a magistrate. And I got out and I went before the magistrate, and the magistrate's looking at what was going on, and he said to the police, "Why did you bring her down here? I told your supervisor, I don't want you bringing these kind of people down here. Why didn't you just give her a citation?" And I'm saying to myself, oh, my God, am I going home? So I'm standing there, and the judge says to the police, "I'm calling your supervisor in the morning." He writes me up this thing. Off I go. I'm like, what the heck? You know, I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to jail. I know I shouldn't have done this, blah, blah, blah. So I got a date to go to this thing in the court in front of the DAs, and I'm just going to come out with it. And I went to my thing and to pay my little fine, and I used someone else's. They didn't ask to see the picture, name, license, or whatever. And they got me in there, and I just had to pay the fine and go home.
You're lucky.
But, you know, I mean, it was, I knew I had done wrong, but I'm like, hey, they got me. I might as well, you know, I didn't kill anybody or anything like that. It was my car that got totaled. The other person didn't. But the point of it is I had no legal license. And actually, I should have really been in jail.
If you were
but
in Florida,
reason,
you would have been arrested for driving without a license. And it was a misdemeanor. It probably would have been.
In North Carolina.
Well, you got lucky. Here they
did
like
get lucky.
Go in jail here.
I did get lucky.
But the system, the problem is that your fun just begins when you get arrested. Now you have to wait if the state is going to, for what charges they're going to file. And if most people suffer for between 8 months and a year and a half, like my two colleagues did and I did, before the outcome happens. And while that was happening, having so much experience, unfortunately, I had family members that ran into a problem and friends that I learned so much over the years. I made this book to help other people and teach them. There's chapters in there on how to seal or expunge a criminal conviction. Again, not violent crimes. If it's a violent crime, it won't help you. But there are people that have made a mistake in life. Happens to everybody. Some people get away with it, some people don't. And their life is ruined because they'll have this minor felony for, like I had from years ago, a criminal mischief one in the 80s. I broke a window. And you can't get any professional licenses then. You're ruined. Mm-hmm. So there has to be avenues that a lot of people are unaware of to get your civil rights restored or to get the case sealed or expunged. And you're allowed to do that in most states. And I teach how to do that. And I go through traffic stops, and I really made this into a real education for people, plus, you know, seeing what they can actually do to you.
So, David, did you actually experience all this, or did you do research and get this book together? Or are these just different crimes that you...
I did a lot of research. Some of them are from experiences that I had with the law. In fact, in 1989, I beat the state of Florida in a landmark case which made Westlaw. When I applied for a gun license and I received the license, and then they took it away from me with all their technicalities, and I challenged the law, which everybody told me I was wasting my time because there wasn't a chance it was beatable. And I'll never forget, on the 24th, to Christmas Eve, my attorney called me and she said, "I'm not going to tell you. You can't believe this. You're going to be on the news tonight. You won the decision. It was a unanimous decision. It's going to be all over the news. You beat the state of Florida in the case." And I have that case in the book that I appealed Florida and I beat them. So you can't give up. You know, you have to fight for your rights. It's not easy. You go through a lot of aggravation. And if you don't have the money, unfortunately, it becomes very hard.
Right. Well, let me ask you this. Do you also have the point where you help people with violent crimes? Do you know any laws as far as, like, dealing with people who did violent crimes, or is it just white-collar and blue-collar crimes that you speak of?
Well, there's always something you can do, but if you get convicted of a violent crime, it's very hard to get it off your record. That's the problem. You know, you can, in certain cases, you can get your civil rights restored, depending on the type of a crime. If it's sex crimes are very hard. Some armed robberies are very hard. Depending on the state, every state has different regulations. But most states, you actually can get a second chance, and a lot of people are unaware of it. And by not having that second chance, it makes people, they go out and commit another crime because they can't earn a living anymore.
Right. Well, what's the difference between a federal offense and a state offense? Because, you know, I was incarcerated some years ago under the federal offense that I had for distribution with intent to distribute a controlled substance. So what is the difference between, you know, a federal and a state offense, or is there a difference?
Big difference. Federal is much harder to get your civil rights restored. You have to apply to the federal government, and they put you through hell to do it, unfortunately. And you can sometimes, the best time to do it, believe it or not, is now. When there's an outgoing president, happens every day. He happens to be a very good president. He's just doing it for a few people here in Florida. You can actually apply now to get a pardon or a civil rights restoration. And when they're outgoing president, this is the perfect time to do it. They usually, if it's, they'll usually help you because they think they're leaving anyway and they can't run for reelection, and they help a lot of people. And he's very good at doing that. He just did it to two people in Florida, exactly the same thing. One spent like 10 years in jail, they were, and she was going to be sentenced to life. I just read it in the paper. And he actually helped her, and she's going to be released in July. She only spent like 10 years. She was supposed to be a, you know, life sentence. So this is a good time to check into that because, you know, when there's an outgoing president, they're very liberal on giving, you know, commuting sentences and helping people that have made a mistake once in life.
Right. Okay, now you said the state is different, and what is the difference in the state? And
state
also,
is much
I know.
To seal or
why is that? Because if you commit a crime that's, I mean, if you commit the same crime, then what is the difference there?
Because you only have to go to the state that you live in to get it sealed, expunged, or civil rights restored. The federal government, you have to apply to the federal government. And, you know, anything with the government is much harder than state. Even bonds are higher on federal. Usually you have to put 15% instead of 10%. I mean, it's a much worse thing.
But don't you get a better jail out of it, though, if you have to go?
I don't know.
Federal?
I don't want to know.
I mean, on a federal charge, they have better jails.
Federal. Well, I know they have camps. I do know that. I don't know about the state, but I do know federal penitentiaries, some of them are camps. Like, because when I was incarcerated, I was incarcerated in Alderson, which is a women's camp, and then I was transferred to Morgantown, which was a co-ed camp. Then I was transferred to Lexington, Kentucky, which is, just a big old federal prison. That's hell, but it was co-ed. But, you know, they do have camps where you can go. They even have it where you, it's almost as if you're being at home, because in Morgantown, it was just like a great big old college campus. There was no, it wasn't fenced in or anything, and there were like six dorms there. Four were filled with men and two were filled with women, and it was just as if he was away at college there. Now, I don't know what it's like now because I was back in the 80s. I understand that it's not co-ed anymore because they had some riots, I think in Atlanta or somewhere, and they transferred the women out. That's why they had sent us to Kentucky. But, the federal penitentiaries, they are, some of them are really nice, you know, if that's the... You know, to be locked up, in other words. But
right,
it's not
right.
Nice to be locked up, period.
For lack of
but
a better word, yeah.
Yeah. So, now, like I said, I don't know about the states because I've never, you know, been involved with the state prison or anything like that. But I do know that I was I'm still a felon as far as that's concerned. Like I said, that was back in the 80s, and they say you can't vote and you can't do this, you can't do that and all this and that. But I've never... the only time I did vote was in the 70s anyway, so it really didn't matter to me losing my voting privileges, and I don't vote. So basically I only had that stigma of being having that that charge still hanging over me, which I really think that after so many years it should be automatically expunged from your record anyway, because why is that still being held over you? You've done your time, and you know, you made restitution. you're living a good life, because I've never went back to what I've done, you know, and I was very remorseful for it and, you know, straightened my life out. So I'm still walking around being considered a felon. But, you know, that's the way of the world. But we're going to take a break.
It's been that long ago. I would research now. This is a good time because you got an outgoing president. Most likely, especially if it's a drug crime and, you know, nobody got killed, no one got murdered, he's more than likely to issue a pardon and restore your civil rights. So at least you'll be able to vote or get any type of professional license if you wanted to again. And this is a very good time to do it now, because he's only going to be here for a little bit longer. And I'm sure you can find out on the Internet how to do it. Just Google it, that you want to have your federal civil rights restored, and there's an application. And this is a perfect time to do it now. Whenever there's an outgoing president, he's leaving anyway, and they do it quite often.
Oh, okay. Well, Larry, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Bringing Sexy Back, right here on Delicious Talk Radio. There is no religion or politics spoken here, only delicious adult conversation. Audience participation is encouraged, so log in and create an account to engage in conversation in our chat room. Feel free to call in with your questions and comments at 646-652-2877. That's 646-652-2877. And let's get this delicious talk conversation going.
When you say, Listen up, I got to tell you about this beautiful author and publisher, Gail Delicious Johnson. Gail Delicious Johnson is proud to announce the publication of her new, revised issue of her latest suspenseful novel, Back to Zero. Read this riveting story of intrigue, conflict, love, and suspense. Follow the trail of abuse, secrets, lies, and love. And check it out. You can't just read the back of the book because you have to prepare yourself for the mind-blowing, explosive ending. Order your personally autographed copy of Back to Zero by visiting www.jjpublishing.com. That's www.jayjaypublishing.com. Back to Zero is a fictional story with a dash of reality. It's a tale about Anthony Thomas, a man who lost the most precious things in his life, starting with his first childhood love, Gloria. Tragedy soon followed after losing his mom to cancer, and shortly thereafter, he lost his wife, Lynn, and son, Junior, in a horrific car crash. With each traumatic incident, Anthony was branded, sending him back to zero. 30 years later, Anthony runs into Gloria, and the flames in their hearts are still burning. Gloria, now a law enforcement official who also comes with baggage, a psychotic husband named Wayne Anderson who is out of control. He, too, is a law enforcement official that's abusive, jealous, and an alcoholic. Wayne treats Gloria miserable. While snooping behind his wife, he finds out that she had research information concerning Anthony on the internet. Wayne goes into a rage of madness like a rabid dog because in his sick, twisted mind, he feels threatened and accuses Gloria of sleeping with Anthony. Often, he would evict her from the house, but not realizing the night would come when he forces his wife straight into the arms of Anthony. After spending an intense, earth-shattering night of lovemaking, Gloria opens up and confesses to Anthony that she still loves him. Rekindling their relationship is dangerous, and Wayne will stop at nothing to make his wife and her first love's life a miserable hell while fighting his own demons. Wayne harbors a deep, dark, and deadly secret, one he thought he and only the devil knew. Find out what happens when Gloria uncovers the truth about her abusive, lawless husband's mysterious past. The devastation will bring the three of them together in an explosive confrontation. Find out the shocking secrets Wayne harbored and prepare yourself for who will pay the ultimate price for his lawless actions. Gail Delicious Johnson says, Back to Zero will take you where the law becomes the abuser. Order this fast-paced, action-packed field drama by best-selling author Gail Delicious Johnson from her web store at JJ Publishing. That's J-A-Y-J-A-Y Publishing.com. Remember, abuse is never an option.
All righty then, we're back. That was DJ Rogers, Say You Love Me, the song selection I selected. And we're here with our special guest this evening, David Merkus, who wrote the book, Wrongly Charged. And it's a very interesting book. I do have it and was, you know, reading through it. And we've discussed him, why he actually wrote the book, because of some injustice that was done to him. And he did a lot of research bringing the book together and had a little tragedy going on, you know, before this, but he made it through. And now we're talking about being branded through the federal and the state laws. But also, I would like to let everybody know that Rhea is in the house. That's my other co-host, and we're going to say good evening to Rhea. How are you, Rhea?
Hi, Rhea. I'm fine. Good evening.
Okay. All right. So, David, let's talk a little bit about the definitions of different things, because I get confused when they say probation and parole. What is the meaning and the difference between probation and parole?
Well, parole is when you're actually in jail and you're sentenced, let's say, to 5 years in jail, and you go before a parole board and they release you early. So you actually do have jail time, and you're getting out early because you have good behavior. So instead of doing the 5 years, they may let you out in 3.5, and you have a parole office. If you make any little mistake, you go right back to jail to finish your sentence. Now, probation, very common, is when instead of getting a jail sentence, they offer you probation, which means if you screw up, you can actually be sentenced to the full amount of what you would have gotten. In other words, let's say you committed a grand theft and you could have been given 5 years in jail, but they give you 5 years probation. If you mess up, you can actually be sent to jail for the 5 years. And being on probation is not an easy thing, because you give up all your rights. I have a whole chapter on that. You have to allow a probation officer to come to your home and do unwarranted searches. She can come at any time, or he can come at any time and say, I want to search your house. If you refuse, they can violate your probation. If you even leave the county that you're on probation in without letting the probation officer know and get permission, if you travel out of the county, that's a technical violation. I mean, it's not easy being on probation if you can't, you know, follow the rules. If you follow the rules, it's not a problem. But one little thing, you know, if you're drinking and driving, if you get arrested for any little thing, it's a violation of probation. So you really have to take it seriously and be very careful when you're on probation.
Okay, now what about on parole? Does a parole officer do the same thing, come to your house and, you know, different things like that? Because I was on probation. They never came to my house, but I do remember I had to give up urine, go see them every week, and what else did I have to do? Get a job. But does a parole officer do the same thing that a probation officer do, you know, go into your house and, like you had mentioned, the probation officer do?
They're usually even stricter, because you're actually just getting out of jail. And depending on the type of probation you're on, there's different types. Like in Florida, they have regular probation where you have to report. They have non-reporting where you have to call in. And then they have, for minor crimes that are misdemeanors, they have what's called administrative probation, where you're not even on the website. You just have to mail in a form and, you know, let them know what's going on. They don't keep tabs on you or anything. And as long as you don't get arrested, you're fine. But, you know, it depends on the probation officer, and it also depends on the charge. If you're on a drug offender probation, they're going to do urine samples and make sure that you're not, you know, doing anything with alcohol or drugs. If you're on probation for shoplifting, you're going to probably have an easy time because, you know, they know it's not a major crime. You didn't hurt anybody. It also depends on the probation officer, too. Some of them can be really nasty, and some of them are very easygoing.
Yeah, because my probation officer, I will admit that I did violate my probation, but he was so set because I had 3-year backup time, you know, but they let me out early. I was facing 20 years. And I got out on good behavior. I only did maybe about 4.5 months because my sentence was cut down because the lawyer that I had, he was a dynamite lawyer. He was one of the top, crime lawyers, or what do you call them?
Criminal defense.
Yeah, criminal defense lawyer. And he, you know, he got it cut down to, 3 months suspended, all but 4 months, 6 months. But I got out of 4.5 on good behavior. So I knew that my probation was violated because I actually saw my probation officer on the street, and I was really trying to duck him. And he told me to come into his office that Monday or something like that. So I went in, and I kept giving up dirty urine. So finally he sends me a paper to come to court, and was trying to, and at this particular time I was feeling like I had turned my life around, but I was working. I had got a job working, because when I got out of jail, I went to school and got certified to be a certified phlebotomist technician. I made a very high score on my tests in spite of me being diagnosed with dyslexia, but I, you know, passed all that, but I just was still dipping and dabbing, you know, in the drug thing and not going to see my probation officer. So when we get to court, oh, my God, it was like I couldn't. But what had happened was I really cleaned myself up, because the last time I went before to give him my urine, I know that it was clean because it was a couple of months before, because he already said that I was going to go back and do those 3 years. And jail, me and jail will never, ever get along. I don't care if it's a camp or whatever. I will never, ever want to be back in jail again in my life. And I made that promise when I got out, but unfortunately I was slipping. So we get in court, and just before the judge got to my case, another guy, he had sent him back to jail because he had been out, didn't get a job, and something else he was doing. So I said, oh, my God, this is a mean judge here. So when it was my turn to, you know, go before the judge, that my lawyer, he was really trying to finagle and figure a way to get me out of it, but my PO, he was upset. He was angered because of the fact I guess it was disrespect to him because I had ignored, you know, coming to see him and, you know, different things. Like, that's only my thoughts of, you know, why he was crying on the way that he did. So finally, I'm sitting in the courtroom. The lawyer's arguing with the probation officer. Probation's arguing with him. The judge is saying whatever he's saying. So something just came over me, and I got up, and I looked at the judge, looked at my PO, and looked at the lawyer, and I said, you know what, none of y'all can help me. I'm put this in God's hands, and whatever happens, happens. And they looked, it got so quiet in the courtroom, you could hear a pin drop on cotton. That's how quiet it got. And the judge, his whole, everybody's expression changed. And then I sat down, and my girlfriend, who I went to court with, she said, girl, what is wrong with you? And I don't know to this day, but something just came over me and told me to get up and say that. And lo and behold, the judge, his whole demeanor changed. The PO, he quieted down. The lawyer, he was, you know, still, I guess he was in shock or whatever. So the judge said, Miss Johnson, because I had given up a urine, he said to my PO, first he said to my PO, he said, I can't remember his name, but he said, does Miss Johnson have a urine that she's given up recently? He said, yes. So the judge looked at me. He said, Miss Johnson, is that urine clean? And I told him, I said, Your Honor, that urine is clean. So he said, well, I'm going to tell you this much. I'm going to let you go this time because I was working in a hospital, had myself established, had a new apartment, you know, different things that I had done in spite of me still dipping, you know, doing the drugs. So he said, I'm going to let you go this time. He said, but hear me and hear me well. The next time if you ever come before me, He said, not only are you going to get those 3 years, but I'm going to tax something else on there as well. And I have not looked back since that day. That was 1983 or something like that. I know it's been almost 30 years ago. I stopped smoking cigarettes. I don't do drugs. I drink on occasions. I've turned my life around. You know, so I know that a person who is remorseful and repentance and do their restitution, I can't understand why things like this should be held over their head. You know, it should be an automatic expungement after so many years, because I'm getting, well, I'm already 65, so it really doesn't even matter to me as far as like voting, because I will never vote. But if I want to do other things that hold a felon back, it may be, you know, something that I really don't want to face up to. So I am going to look into the fact of getting that expunged, you know, just for the sake of having my name back, because I don't really think that it should be a tarnish by something that I've done 30 years ago, especially if it wasn't anything violent, you know, but that's just the system.
What state was it in?
It was in Washington, D.C.
Okay, but you...
and D.C. is really not in the state, but... Pardon?
The problem with getting it sealed or expunged in 99% of the states that I'm aware of, in order to get it sealed or expunged, it either has to be a withheld adjudication, which means you weren't convicted, but you were, or you have to be dismissed. So the only thing you'll be able to do is either get a pardon or get your civil rights restored, which in essence at your age will do everything. In other words, you'll have the arrest record, but you would be able to apply for any professional license, and they couldn't deny you based on the conviction. So at your age, it's not like you're going to, you know, going into a major career, so you can get your civil rights restored. And if it's been a long time ago, it will take about 6 months to do. Most states will do it within 6 months. It wasn't a violent crime. To get it sealed or expunged, you only can do that is if it was a dismissal, if you're found not guilty, or if it was a withheld. Like Florida offers what's called a first-time offenders. They'll give you, you can plead guilty to a felony, but they'll withhold adjudication, which means technically you're not a convicted felon. And if you never had anything sealed or expunged before, I've done this for a few people for free. I've helped them out. You can file for a certificate from the state of Florida, and then you bring it to court, and they issue it in order to seal or expunge the crime, but only under those circumstances.
Okay.
But
now
you can get your civil rights restored. And believe it or not, with your civil rights restored, you have to still list that you have the conviction. But on the other hand, you could actually even get a firearms license if you have the civil rights restored in the state where the conviction occurred. So if you go to Washington and apply for it, it's been years ago, you'll probably get it, and then you can apply for a real estate license. They can't deny you because you have your civil rights restored. They have to accept that.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Wow, you know, and it's just so bad how they strip you of everything after you locked up in a cage. And, you know, then you still have these stigmas on you. But we're going to move on. Plea bargain. Now, let's talk about plea bargain, because I've seen cases where someone would accept a plea bargain and then regret it. Then some accept the plea bargain and be satisfied with it. So what is the big deal with plea bargaining, and is it really worth it?
Most people take a plea for two reasons: fear and money. An example, in our three cases, at the end, the other two guys, the cases were completely dismissed, $30,000 in legal fees later, okay, which you don't get reimbursed, so you lose even if you win. Now, in my case, since I made front page of the newspaper and that they had spent an 8-month investigation on this case, with forensic experts, you wouldn't believe the money that was spent on this case. You would have thought there was a murder involved. All it was unfair competition at best, which happens every day. And they spent all this money, so they had no intentions of dropping the charges on my case. Now, you had an option. I already was into my case because there were such serious charges in credit card debt for $50,000 in legal fees. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you take the case to trial, which I think I could have won. There's no question I don't think they could have got a guilty verdict, but there's always a chance, you know. I would have faced 20 years in prison. I would, if I wanted to do that, the attorneys wanted another $35,000, and win or lose, I'm not going to see that $35,000 back. See that? So I would have been into this instead of for $50,000 or $60,000 for almost $100,000. So when we got down to the nitty-gritty, since they weren't willing to drop the charges, they made me an offer that the average person couldn't refuse. They offered, in my case, I should plead guilty to misdemeanor petty theft with a withheld adjudication, which means it's not even a conviction, and a little bit of probation on a misdemeanor charge. So I'm thinking to myself, I might as well take that, because now I'm not going to spend another $35,000, even though I didn't want to plead guilty to something I didn't do. People do it. And I did it because I didn't want to spend $35,000 just to get the joy, the jury, find the defendant not guilty, because they're not going to say, okay, the defendant is awarded all court costs, attorney's fees, and legal, you know, then I would have done it. But you don't get your money back. So I took a plea in my case because, listen, a misdemeanor for petty theft isn't so terrible, and the adjudication was withheld. But that's what most people do, because if you go to trial and lose, they would have sentenced me to 20 years in jail for something that should be a civil matter. There's no question about it. So I didn't want to take the risk in my case. And they put you through, you know, a lot of legal fees, and even the guys, the case was dismissed. You know, one guy at this point, just before I finished writing the book, actually had the case expunged from the record. It cost him a fortune in legal fees. No apologies, no nothing.
Wow.
System
that
really
sounds almost like intimidation, you know.
Well, that's what
because
it was.
Right.
It got even worse because at the time I wanted this book to come out, which it just was released in the end of February, the Department of Corrections, which I did, like I said, I had a probation, was very upset about this book because I reveal everything in the book, and even the real names of the people are in there.
Wow.
And and I let them know what they spent on the case. I don't give dollar amounts, but you can use your imagination. So they weren't very happy about this. So probation was, we don't want you to come out with this book until your probation's over. And I said, the book's coming out. It's been published already. You're not going to stop me. And I had to actually go to court, and I got a court order from the judge about 4 weeks ago, and he issued an order to the Department of Corrections not to interfere in any way on any of my interviews, and I can travel to promote the book. So they were very shocked at that. You know, they actually were on my side. So there was a lot of controversy. My case was very watched. You know, you would have thought it was a murder trial. But they're not happy about the book. It's drawn a lot of media attention.
Wow. Somebody had a question?
Yeah, I'm just coming in on it, and I apologize.
Hi, Jade.
Hi. I do apologize for my lateness. I do want to just ask, because, again, I am just coming into it, why were they trying to stop you from publishing your book and doing your interviews on your story?
Well, because basically they feel, you know, when you take a plea in a case, it's a very bad thing, because even though I didn't plead guilty to the real charges, you're actually going in front of a judge saying, you know, you're writing a book wrongly charged, but yet you pled guilty. That was their answer. But the judge actually read through the lines and said, you know, people all the time plead guilty to crimes as a convenience. And I wasn't writing a book telling people how to steal from people, which would be what they were trying to say, like how to profit from your criminal activity. I was writing a book to tell people what really happened, the truth, and how to help yourself if you get arrested, and what your rights are and everything like that, and how to get out of jail without seeing a judge. I don't say anything derogatory about anybody in the book. I just tell the story the way it happened.
How did they find out that you were publishing a book?
It was all over the news, because the minute the felony charges were dropped 2 months after, when they decided to drop the felony charges, I hired somebody to help me with the book, because I never wrote a book before, and they press releases went out all over the place, and even the state attorney found out about it. Everybody found out. They were very unhappy about it, but they really couldn't do anything about it because there's nothing derogatory. I don't, you know, say anything bad about anybody. I just tell it the way it is, the way what really happened.
Right.
Wow.
And unfortunately, there's a lot of sad stories of people. I have a story of one of my customers that actually was involved in a traffic accident here in Boca Raton, Florida. And he was offered a plea deal, and he had the best attorney. And because he didn't take the plea deal, it's amazing what happens to you. They don't ever, if they offer you a plea deal and you ever turn it down, they're angry that you dared to take up the court's time to go trial. And a lot of people don't realize that. That's why people are scared. They'll take, even in my case, they threaten me. They don't. The judge won't. The judge will ask you, "Were you threatened?" You can't tell her yes. But if you don't take the deal, and God forbid the jury doesn't like you for whatever reason, and you're found guilty, you're going to get close to, if not the maximum sentence.
Wow, that's, oh my goodness, that is really terrible.
It's scary.
You know, because some people took plea bargains and they still, you know, came off on the bottom. So
there's a whole chapter in here which is even more scary, wrongly convicted from the Innocence Project, how he helped people that have spent, unfortunately, they're always minorities in most cases that they do this to, and they spent 15 and 20 years of their life in jail for crimes they didn't commit. I have video, you know, YouTube links in here from videos how a guy got out. He spent 20 years. We're sorry. That's all. 20 years he spent. You know, it's a terrible thing.
And they can't give that time back, and they try to give them restitution for it or whatever, but no amount of money can buy your life back, your time, and, you know, precious memories and things that happened while you were locked up. You know, and then some of them, they're not even compensating them enough money when they do that. You know, somebody spent 20, 30 years of their life in jail for a crime they didn't commit, and they give them $1 million. That money will be gone with the quickness. You know, give them $1 million for each year they spent in prison. You know, how about that?
Unfortunately, there's only 15 states that even offer compensation at this time. There are certain states that don't even offer that. You get out, the judge says, "I'm sorry, it was a mistake." Not the judge's fault.
Wow. And then what about
somebody
when...
Go on.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say... Go ahead, Jade.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Jade.
I just wanted to ask if do they ever, like, I know some of these people didn't have anything expunged, which is terrifying and terrible, because once they have that record, even if you're innocent and proven innocent later on, exonerated from it, seems like they can't get a job.
I think you're breaking up, Jade.
Yeah, I heard a thing about sealing or expunging, which is I have a whole section in the book about. Yes, she's right about that, but.
Well, is there any way that there can be a law, or somebody can bring a law that will guarantee a wrongly convicted individual some type of compensation?
They're working on it. States are starting to do that now.
I mean, that's
my whole thing about the sealing and expunging thing is there's a law that says you can only seal or expunge a crime one time. The sad part of it is if the charge is dismissed, you have to use that one time for something that should be an automatic expunge. For example, let's say a guy gets pulled over, it happened to a friend of mine, and a girl points him out for a rape charge, and they dismiss it. He'll never get a job because he's been charged with aggravated rape, which is a serious charge, and now the charge is dismissed, but people look at him bad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's on his record for life.
And that prevents people from getting apartments and different things like that.
Sure.
That's what I was saying when you said I was breaking up, that it's sad because there's people who are innocent, proven innocent later, women have so much issues with that kind of stuff or getting a new getting a decent job.
That's it happens every day. There are people that have charges that are dismissed against them. But unfortunately, an employer runs a record, and he runs your arrest record. And if it says aggravated rape, charge dismissed, not going to be too likely to hire you, even though it was dismissed.
Right. Because you're sort of like blackballed.
That's why if it's a dismissed case and you live in one of the states that you can seal and expunge, it's something you can do. A lot of states do offer that, and a lot of people are unaware of that. And, you know, and they walk around with that on their record, and they can't get a job.
Yeah, because it's just like being in a courtroom, and the defendant, the lawyer on the prosecution side has said something he shouldn't have. Well, the jury's already heard it.
Oh, yeah, I know. Trials are very scary because it can go, you can, you know, and it costs you money. See, the laws need really to be changed. These things wouldn't happen, like to me, if the prosecution knew they had a weak case and there was no chance of a conviction, and they knew that if they lost, they'd have to pay all us three back for all our court costs and attorney's fees and bail bondsmen. It would have cost them over $100,000 on top of what they spent. They probably never would have filed the case. Unfortunately, that's not the way it works in criminal cases. So you can arrest anybody and it costs them money. Even if you just want to punish them, like, which is what they actually did to us, they cost us money. And you'll never see that money back. Even the two guys that the charges were dismissed that went through hell and spent time in jail, no apology, no nothing.
Wow.
It's an amazing thing, and it happens every day.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about preliminary hearing. What is that?
Well, that's normally if you don't bond out of jail. There are, so like you said before, there are certain people that can't afford the bail. So then you will get what's called a preliminary hearing, and the judge will hear the evidence, and he'll review the charges, dismiss, drop, or whatever it is, and at that point they'll set a reasonable bond, unless, again, if it's a violent crime, you can sit there, unfortunately.
Okay, does the defendant have to be present and for the preliminary hearing?
If you bond out of jail, like in most cases that people do, most people have an attorney at that point, they waive the preliminary hearing. It's not necessary.
Okay.
It's mainly for people that can't get out of jail.
Okay. What about a pretrial diversions?
Okay, that's an interesting thing. That's offered in a lot of states. The pretrial diversion is actually what happened to one of my guys, that the independent contractors. Basically, it's like probation, but it's not. It's for a first-time nonviolent offender. And what happens is you're not really put on probation. You're put into this program that if you complete the program in 12 months, which basically means you stay out of trouble, the charges are actually dismissed. And that's what happened to one of the guys, the second guy in my book. He couldn't afford an attorney. He used legal aid, and they offered him the PTI, pretrial diversion or intervention, and in 12 months he didn't get in any trouble, so it's listed as charges dismissed on his case too.
Okay, well, this has been a very, very interesting show this evening, and I do appreciate your coming on and spending this time with us and giving my listening audience as much knowledge as, you know, was allowed. And why don't you let everybody know how they can get your book and how they can keep up with you, David?
Okay, first of all, we have a website, www.wronglycharged.com. We can view some cases and see a little bit of a video of what happened. And then the book is available at Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, and Books A Million. All three chains are now carrying it. And I have a toll-free number, 844-WRONGLY, if anyone needs any help, if I can help anybody in any way, or **WRONGLY from any cell phone.
Okay. Now, you broke up a little bit when you was giving out the website, so can you do that again, give it out again?
Yes. www.wronglycharged.com. And you should note that 10% of the profits of this book are being put aside in a fund to help people that can't afford and have been wrongly charged with crimes.
Oh, well, that is just marvelous. That is so good to hear, because generally when there's nobody to help anybody, you know, they can stay in jail or whatever, but that's a good thing, you know. And I'm going to say I appreciate you doing that for people who can't afford it. You know, that's a good thing. So do any of my co-hosts have any closing remarks for David? Or, David, you have any closing remarks you'd like to make before we shut the studio down?
Well, basically, the book is not only about my story. It's a complete legal guide with glossaries in there. And I think I have had very good positive reviews on it. And I think it's a very helpful thing for people. It's an interesting story. And unfortunately, it happens every day. And I wrote it mainly to help other people, not to make a big profit off the book.
Right. Well, it's definitely a good book, because I've been, you know, reading it and checking out some of the things in it. So now I know a little bit more than I did when it comes to the law, because I had also went to court because two police officers pulled me over. I was driving my daughter's car, and she has these very dark tinted windows, very dark. So I had to go to court for them. They wrote me a ticket, and I wasn't going to pay the ticket. I was, you know, going to fight it, because when I got to court, I told the judge, I said, "Well, Your Honor, I think I was maybe 63, something like that, when that happened. I said, I'm 63, and I don't know how dark a car window shield should be or not." So you know what he said? He said, "Ignorance of the law." What did he say? He said,
"That's right. I know exactly what you're going to say."
Yeah, he said,
I should
know
that.
The law
is not an excuse. I know.
Right. But, you know, I didn't, you know, it wasn't like I was, you know, because I understand when it's so dark and the police can't see in the car, they fear for their life or whatever. But they saw me because they followed me right in front of my door. I was at the gas station. Now, they knew that it was only one person in the car, because in the front of the car, you could see in the car. They followed me to the front of my door, pulled me over, and, you know, gave me this, said this, and then I had to, you know, pay this ticket, or even you can fight it. And I fought it, and I think I ended up paying maybe half of the ticket or something like that. I really didn't even want to pay any of it, but the judge said ignorance is not, what is it, to the law.
An excuse for the law or something.
Yeah, no excuse for the law. But there are a lot of people out there that don't know the law and are, you know, being taught it every day, because it's not like people running around with law books and you know, staying in law libraries for what reason, not unless you become a lawyer or whatever, but, you know, there are things that they sort of like nitpick with people and, you know, want to get their quotas in and, you know, different things like that. But I said all that to say I learned, you know, a few more things than what I did know. And hopefully my listening audience did, and hopefully my fabulous co-hosts as well did. So, you know, we're getting ready to shut this show down. And with that being said, we're going to give you a great big round of applause. Okay, David, and once again, give out that website once again, dear.
www.wronglycharged.com.
Okay, and where can they get your books?
Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, or Books a Million.
Okay. All righty then. Rhea, you want to let everybody know how to get in touch with you?
Hi, I can be reached. This is Rhea Alexis Banks. I am a voracious reader and an avid book reviewer. I can be reached primarily on Facebook. That's actually the easiest way to reach me. And I also have a website that is Rhea Alexis, that's R-H-E-A-A-L-E-X-I-S, .wordpress.com.
Well, all right. Okay, all right. Okay, Jade, you want to let everybody know how they can get in touch with you?
They can, they can get in contact with us every Thursday night at 9 p.m. Eastern on Erotic Talk Radio, also on Blog Talk Radio. We have a group page on Facebook, Erotic Talk Radio, and we have a group community on Google Plus, also Erotic Talk Radio. And they can check us out at eroticexpression.com as well.
All righty then. Thank you, darling. And Terry, tell everybody about you.
Well, I'm the baby of the group. Not in age, but I'm the baby of the group. And a novice writer, love to read, have always done so. You can reach me or see me or see any of my food that I put on Facebook under Terry, T-E-R-R-I-E, New Attitude, one word, Brown-COX. You can find me on Facebook.
Oh, okay. And you guys know who I am, Gail Delicious Johnson, the host of Bringing Sexy Back. You know, we're here every Thursday. And as you know, Bringing Sexy Back is for the mature listening audience, and our subject matter is sometimes sexual, but not limited to other social topics. We discuss relationships, current events, and issues relevant to every day. We appreciate you, David, for being our guest this evening and our listening audience. And if you have a topic and you'd like for us to discuss or would like to be a guest on the show, send an email to me. That's gjdelicious37@gmail.com. And in the subject line, type topic or guest. We're here every Wednesday at 10:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, giving you guys the best guests and adult conversations on Blog Talk Radio. Remember, bringing sexy back does not mean you've lost your sexy. Bringing sexy back is a state of mind and how you perceive yourself. Thanks, Rhea, Jay, Terry, and my listening audience. And I love you guys. Be safe. Have a wonderful weekend. And if you're driving, don't drink. If you're drinking, don't drive. I love talking to you guys, not about you. And I want to make the same announcement that I made at the beginning of the show. In May, I think, well, I'm not really sure, but I think in May we're going to be on hiatus indefinitely because I had some unforeseen circumstances to come up. But, you know, all the emails that I got, I will have you guys on as soon as possible. I'm going to finish out this month. And, you know, when I can get back, I will be back. But until then, you can listen to the archives, and we still can communicate. But, you know, like I said, Blog Talk will be on hiatus for, you know, a little while. And I really did enjoy being on here, and I'm not going anywhere. It's just, you know, that I'm going to be not on here for a little while. And when we come back, we're going to come back with a bang. So my co-host, you girls be prepared, and the guests as well. So again, I want to say thank each and every one of you for hanging in there with me every Wednesday. You know, you could have been anywhere doing anything else, but you was right here with your girl, you know, listening and supporting me and, you know, just being there for me. And I love each and every one of you for that. And, you know, everybody have a beautiful weekend. And I'll talk to you guys next week.
Okay.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, Gail.
Good night.
All right. Love you.
Good night.
Thank you for listening to my Nana's Internet Radio Show because it's the best. Good night.